Show me your teeth. Show me your teeth.
Welcome to Vampire Hype. This episode is going to be slightly different from the ones that we've been doing so far because this is going to be all about Twilight. Breaking Dawn Part 2 has finally hit cinemas and all of us are really anxious to talk about it. We've got myself, Selena, and Tariq here, and we've also got Jen and Laura back to talk about Twilight. We're really excited to have you guys on again.
Thanks, it's going to be fun.
Yeah, it'll be great.
Yay! And, you know, one of the reasons we do have you guys on, despite the fact that we obviously want you on, is because you know a lot about Twilight, and I think it's going to hopefully add a lot to the discussion. Laura is going to be leading our Twilight segment, which is going to be the whole show, but before we do that, I just want to briefly recap the contact information for you guys. You can follow us on Twitter at Vampire Hype, and you can, of course, find us on hypeable.com. That's hypeable.com, which is where we post news for a variety of fandoms, and we also have a lot of different podcasts. I know that Jen and Laura, you both, I think since you've last been on the show, probably, maybe not. You're on, it doesn't matter when you started it, you're on Who Hype. It's where I was going with that sentence, the Doctor Who podcast, and it's a lot of fun to listen to. So if we've got any Doctor Who fans listening, be sure you check that out because it's a good podcast.
Yep. And in fact, we're recording an episode, I mean, practically right after we record this, we're recording Who Hype.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of podcasting going on today. I've got a Game of Thrones podcast later today, and I know the Merlin podcast is recording as well. So,
and we have Once of All tonight, too.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, a big podcasting day today. All right. And, of course, if you are a Vampire Diaries fan, the reason that we're not doing an episode about that this week is also because there was no Vampire Diaries episode, but next week we will have the show back to discuss the episode My Brother's Keeper, which is coming out on Thursday, just to catch you guys up on what's going on there. But I think that's enough for me because we've got a lot of Twilight talk to get into. So do you want to take that away, Laura?
Sure, definitely. So Breaking Dawn Part 2 finally hit theaters. It's the final installment in the Twilight Saga movies. I mean, unless we're going to have a reboot or something like that, this is going to be it for a while. And it was the second installment by director Bill Condon. Everybody else had directed just one series in the franchise, but Bill Condon directed Breaking Dawn Parts 1 and 2 that they shot concurrently. So what did you guys each think about the movie? Was it a thumbs up for you, thumbs down, somewhere in between? What did you guys think about it?
It was a thumbs in between for me.
Mm.
I enjoyed it quite a lot. I don't know if that's a real term, but I liked it a lot, and there are some things that I had a pretty big issue with, though, but we can get into that later. But for general up and down, it's in between for me.
I'm going to give it a thumbs up. I think that I've used on Twitter, I used the word cute to describe this film, and I think that pretty much sums up what I think. It was cute. I liked it.
For me, I liked it better than I liked the book. I thought that the movie gave us a little bit more than the book did, because I was, honestly, Breaking Dawn was not, I've only ever read it once. It was my least favorite of the books, so the movie definitely ranked higher than the book for me. So for most parts, I give it a thumbs up.
Have we all read the book here?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Multitudinous times with highlighting
right,
in it. But yeah, no, for me, it was a thumbs up, too. I don't know that it's my favorite movie in the series. I liked it. It was more of a, it was definitely a thumbs up for me. But I after, like, weighing it for a while and trying to decide which of the movies in the series was my favorite, I don't think this one is quite it, but that's not to say that I disliked it. But it's definitely, it was not my favorite of the series. I think Breaking Dawn Part 1 is probably my favorite of all the movies. Thinking about, like, the movie itself, there was, I would say that it was definitely, like, very quick-paced, going, like, from scene to scene to scene to scene to scene. And I think for one of the first things that I noticed in this movie is that we finally had some more dialogue with people who were, at best in other movies, like, tertiary characters. Like, you know, we finally got to see Emmett do something more than grunt. You know, same thing with Jasper, got some more dialogue. Like, we definitely got some more action with various people in there. Did you guys have any scene in particular that stood out in your mind as a favorite, whether it was a touching one or a funny one or an action scene? Anything that you really liked in particular in this movie?
Well, this is kind of random, and I know that Tariq probably also wanted to talk about this, but I really liked Benjamin. He really stood out to me as a character. And I've sort of been joking about it when we were discussing doing the show that he was the only one whose name I remembered. That's not completely true. I do remember most of the vampires, but he had a really interesting presence. You know, I think it was like his eyes. They were like looking into my soul. And every time he was on screen, I was like, oh my God. So I want to say him, because all his scenes, I sort of remember them more, but I'm not really sure why.
Yeah, I agree. Benjamin was my favorite character, I think, in the book. Just because he can manipulate the elements.
He's an avatar, basically.
So... Oh, man. He totally is. He was, like, my favorite one. And so, him in the movies, he was fantastic. Though, for my favorite scene, that was definitely when Bella was arm wrestling Emmett. That was just hysterical.
Oh, yes, that was good.
I think for me, I, even though it's semi-not canon, which I know we'll talk about later, I really liked the battle scene, because I felt like, in the book, we didn't get that. We didn't have that resolution that everything felt was leading up to that. So it was kind of cool to get that. And to sit in a theater and have people react the way they did was probably the most comical thing ever. Because I had people literally sitting in front of me screaming and jumping up and down. Some woman almost hit the guy sitting next to her. Like, it was fantastic to watch people's reactions during that fight scene. It made it completely worth it.
I think one of my favorite scenes was getting to see those scenes that expand a little bit about things that we just heard about. I loved watching that whole immortal children scene when they're explaining what the immortal children are. And you see that, like, I don't know, I don't think the baby was even like 2 years old who had apparently just devoured a village.
Oh, yeah.
And there's like the blood dripping, like blood, little spittle dripping down the side of the baby's face, and like Jane's picking him up going, no, 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 you've been naughty. It was just like, you know, the Volturi are ruthless. Like you knew that from the second movie and from the third movie. But I think it was really cool to see just how ruthless could be. I mean, you're killing a baby, and, you know, and then the baby's mother and everything else like that too. I mean, I just thought that was like, I was like, okay, that made, you know, because like hearing about it in the book was one thing, but I thought seeing them, they're gonna kill a baby, and she takes the baby and she tosses him. I'm like, oh my God, that was pretty impactful for me.
I didn't even remember that scene. Was that in the book?
They talk about how the Volturi hunted down the immortal children, and like I mean, it's kind of like the book was sort of like Edward's voiceover that kind of narrated it, saying, look, this is what they were and this is why they had to get rid of them. But like, I guess in the book, because Edward's just kind of dispassionately narrating it, and he says, you know, the Denalis, you know, felt about that very strongly, because one of the people affected by this was their own mother and their own brother. But like, I think it's just different from hearing in the book Edward kind of dispassionately narrating it versus you seeing, you know, they're taking a baby and toss, you know, ripping a baby's head off and tossing him into the fire. It's like, oh my God. You know, that's, I think, definitely, I mean, brutal. That was, and then it was kind of interesting, like, I thought later on, like, you realize that there is no room for mistake with the Volturi. Like, it's very, everything is very black and white. There's no other form of justice. The only penalty for anything is really death. Everything is very black or white as far as that's concerned. And when Irina realizes she's made a mistake, she knows there's no way out for her. And I just kind of loved how she just turned to her family and just mouthed, I'm sorry, because she knows it, because she knows it's it. There's no coming back for that. She's going to die, and she's caused her own death. I thought that was really pretty amazing.
I appreciated seeing more of Maggie Grace as well, because, you know, as an old Lost fan, that's always fun, so.
Yeah, I also thought in the wedding scene, I don't know if it was just me, like, but back in the previous movie, like, you had these three women that are blonde as blonde could be, in the palest of pale dresses, with the big golden eyes, and for me, they've just, I don't know. They were just,
it looked odd.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It was one of the few moments that I really disliked in Breaking Dawn, one is that I thought they were very, like, and especially Maggie Grace, just I felt like looked like deer in headlights.
Effective,
yeah, really. Like it was, and I know that it's really hard for them to focus in those gold contacts and everything, but I felt like especially like Maggie Grace in that scene was just, she just looked too fake. But in this, I felt like she was human. I mean, I know she's a vampire, but I felt like, you know, you got her humanity through it, and I don't feel like you got that in the first movie.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I thought she did a really, really excellent job. And as the whole Denali clan, actually, I thought they had a really, really interesting and strong presence in the film. I think it was a good choice for them to focus so much on, oh, what was her name? The main Denali one.
Mianna Burring Irina, no, Kate, by Casey LeBeau. Yeah.
Yes, Kate. I thought that she had, like, even though I still think that the eyes made them really, really, like, not pretty and just weird to look at, I really enjoyed the fact that she got a bit of a side story.
Yeah, I wish they had, because, I mean, in the book, that is sort of one of my more favorite moments of Breaking Dawn. I mean, I agree with Jen, Breaking Dawn is not my favorite book in the series. There are elements of it, though, in that book that are amongst my favorite moments in the series, though, and one of my favorite minor story arcs in Breaking Dawn is the whole Kate and Garrett segment, so I really, really enjoyed watching her and the two of them interplay, because they were definitely some of my favorites reading the book.
He was so cool as well.
Oh, could you not love Lee Pace? Yeah, seriously. Seriously. Oh my gosh, was he amazing. Loved him.
I really liked the scene where they find him in the alley getting his dinner. I thought that was a really just fun way to introduce him and kind of who he was. And like, he's a little bit arrogant, a little bit, you know, non-apologetic for who and what he is. And I really kind of enjoyed that scene as well. I thought that was really fun.
Me too. To be honest, I really enjoyed most of the vampires. Like, even if I do have to say that the blatant cultural stereotyping did kind of grate on me. Like, don't even get me started on the Amazon. I'm talking about the Irish. Like, that was just the time they were on screen.
Yeah.
There was the man with the hat and the red-haired woman and the girl with the dark curls. And I was like, are you serious?
Well, apparently, from what I understand, that and I've heard this from multiple people who live in Ireland. I mean, one of the benefits of also running, you know, Twilight Lexicon is a lot of people will, you know, tweet us or send me an email. I guess I didn't really think about it at the time because, to me, in a sense, they sort of, you know, were a bit of stereotyped characters coming from different areas or regions. Although, you know, I suppose the Egyptians didn't look like ancient Egyptians, so it does make you wonder why the Irish look like they walked right off a boat from the potato famine. But I do remember at one point going, yeah, they do kind of look like they're about to, you know, huddle around a peat fire by wondering why the taters are poisoned this year and, you know, can they get on that boat to America in a better life? I mean, they really do look like they're just ready to make that immigrant journey documentary. I guess I agree with you. You're right when you say that styling. Apparently everybody else has kind of moved along with the decades, yet the Irish have kind of stuck to that 1860s potato famine imagery.
It distracted me.
I mean, I get that the Amazons were like living off like the animal skins in the jungle, but like the Egyptians look kind of modern, I guess we could say, with like some cultural influences into their environment. And I guess you could say the Romanians were kind of, I mean, they were like rocking the whole black leather look. So clearly they were, you know, more modern in their appearance too, and definitely the Denalis and Garrett and all. I mean, they each had a style, but everybody else, I guess, did tend to modern gear, and the Irish, for whatever reason, didn't modernize. They kind of stayed as they were.
They were weird, the Romanians, weren't they?
They were my favorites. Oh, man.
Really?
They were so
creepy. Oh, I love them.
They were so creepy. Well, this probably a good time to seg into that. Tarek, so the Romanians were your favorites. What did you like about the Romanians?
I love, like, the over-the-top, just everything about them, their accents, the way they were just so creepy, and, like, Jacob worded it perfectly. Like, he just, like, they're just creepy, and I love it. I love how creepy they are, because, I don't know, just, they were so funny, and every single time I saw them, I was like, oh, man, they're great. I mean, they're kind of annoying, but they're great.
They are. I love their voices, too. They were just, like, they were like Dracula enough that it was like you got the homage, but it wasn't, like, it didn't grate on you. It was, like, just enough, I felt.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
They were entertaining. I mean, I did feel like they were a little stereotypical, but they were enjoyable in the sense when they told their story about how they got complacent and then Aro and everyone came in and kind of took over from them and how they want to get them back. I think that was kind of the most fun aspect of their character, was their need to avenge themselves with Aro and want to get the Volturi back and like kind of make sure they got theirs, and that's why they were there in the first place. I thought that was really fun, and how they kind of portrayed that was really fun.
I loved how they were, like, so disappointed in the end that, like, there wasn't a bloodbath. You know, like, they were like, what do you mean? Oh, we want to fight! We want to fight! They were, like, so disappointed that they didn't get their real bloodbath at the end. That was, I thought that was cute.
I think they weren't alone. At least if my audience in the cinema was anything to go by, that was probably a popular opinion.
Yeah. I guess we're going to talk about that later, but that the whole vision and then finding out it was a vision, I think a lot of people were disappointed, including those Romanians.
Anybody else have new favorite vampires in the lot there?
I kind of really liked Alistair, even though he's like creepy old uncle in the attic. I really kind of liked that he was creepy and like standoffish, and the way he observed and stuff I thought was really cool. And when he spoke, he was very poignant and accurate with what he was saying. Like, he had a purpose, and so I kind of liked that about him. Even though he was very standoffish, he was always observing and always watching to see what would happen next. So I liked that about him, and I thought Joe Anderson did a great job with that character.
Yeah, I liked him a lot too. It was funny because I had gotten an opportunity to talk to Melissa Rosenberg, who's the screenwriter, and that's actually something I asked her about. I said, you know, you have all these new vampires, it's really easy to get lost in the shuffle, you know, in the book. Even when you're reading, you're like, oh wait, who is that one again? And I think I agree with you, Jen, like in the book, I always felt like, oh yeah, Alistair, he's the creepy dude that goes to the attic, doesn't say very much, and then like takes off. And I don't think you remember him that well in the book, but I felt like in the movie, and definitely the way it was written, plus the way Joe Anderson played it, like you definitely got the sense that he was like, I don't know if you want to call it the voice of reality, but maybe the voice of you know, you've got a lot of witnesses here, and the reality is that we could all still die. He was just, like, he was definitely going to be the guy who was going to say, yeah, the glass is half empty. You know what? As a matter of fact, the glass is, like, three quarters empty. Like, he was just going to be the voice of reality, and I thought that was pretty good the way he did that. Okay, so why don't we talk a little bit about, Tarek, you were mentioning it too. I mean, I think when it comes down to it in this, from what I've seen it, there's a couple of camps of controversy regarding changes from canon. Obviously, in canon, in the books, basically have a big, what Stephanie Meyer intended. Now, whether you think this delivered or not, I know that's another whole controversy in of itself, but Stephanie Meyer intended it to be like a courtroom drama-esque, Merchant of Venice-esque, I will outthink you, I will out-talk you kind of scenario. And I know a lot of people debate whether or not that really is effectively done in the books, whether or not that was her intent or not. So we end up with this battle scene that comes up. And so that's a break from canon in that, you know, obviously the battle scene doesn't come up. Aro doesn't actually get his hands on Alice in the book to know what, you know, if he makes different decisions, what would be the outcome. So that's one element of controversy. And then the other element of controversy that I've also heard of is that there are people saying, well, if the wolves are intermingled in this battle and Alice can't see the action of the wolves, how come she could see clearly battle outcomes if the wolves were around? So I don't know. Good point. Good question. Who knows the answers to those? So what do you guys think about, you know, the change from canon? Does it work? Does it not work? How do you guys come down on this?
I think somewhere back in an interview, Stephanie had said that when Alice goes to see Aro, that she shows him the vision, that it is what would happen should they choose to fight them. I swear that that's somewhere listed. So that it's not completely out of canon, because that's the point of it.
Yeah, it's not it. Yeah, it's
and in the movie. So yeah, we just get to see what we don't see on the page because Bella doesn't read Alice's mind.
Yeah, I don't think that Aro in the book, I could be wrong, I don't think Aro in the book actually lays his hand on Alice. So for him to be able to see, like, every thought in your head,
right?
He's got to actually physically touch you.
Right. I thought, okay, because somewhere there is an interview that said
you're
that.
You're absolutely right.
I'm almost positive. Because a couple other people brought it up as well.
Yeah, you are not incorrect. There is an interview that goes back to, like, 2008, and you've got to go digging for it. I don't even remember where it was. It was somewhere on the Breaking Dawn tour, and I don't remember which stop it was.
Technically, in her mind, that's how it plays out, even though we don't see it on the page because we can't, because of point of view. However, the big question is, and it's kind of a big plot hole, Alice can never see the wolves, so how can she show them the battle? Because the wolves are a part of the battle. So that is a big gaping kind of, oopsie, we're going to ignore those rules because we want this to happen. And to some extent, honestly, I'm okay with it because I think the battle scene is really cool. And again, it gives us that kind of sense of being finished with it because we didn't know what happened. It was very, very anticlimactic in the book where it's just like, I'm going to protect them with this invisible shield that isn't really a super cool power and, you know, and all this other stuff, and you get nothing. You kind of get this, okay, yeah, we're going to go home now. Yep. Thanks for playing. Very, like, I'm staring at you, you're staring at me, and I won the staring contest, yay! So I personally liked the fact that there was a battle in the movie.
Yeah.
Canon or not, no one really died in the end, you know, but, so I personally liked the fact that there was some resolution to that big standoff.
Can I just say, I love that the shield did not look like the big bubble from Star Wars. Because I was sitting in a chat with somebody where they brought that up, and I was just like, oh my god, I'm so glad you said that, because I was thinking that it was going to look, you know what I mean, like that big bubbly thing in one of the last Star Wars movies. I kind of liked that. I mean, and again, that was sort of different from canon too. I mean, like, Bella in her whole shield thing is basically supposed to be able to shield 30 people, not just, like, people within, like, 5-6 feet of her, so they definitely changed that too. But I did like the visual effect on the shields. I was glad that it didn't look like Bella and her giant soap bubble surrounding her, because I was afraid that it could have looked like that.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to say I agree with Jen. I think that I was really happy that they did put this final battle in. And I, you know what I was really happy with was that whenever Breaking Dawn, the book, came out and everybody were pitching a fit about the fact that it didn't have a big battle to end with, and Stephanie Meyer came out with those comments saying, you know what, if I'd had a big battle, half of the people that we all love would have died, and I just couldn't bring myself to do that. And I mean, I just remember coming away from that interview, I wasn't really that upset with the book. I thought it was fine. But that interview left me really upset because, like, but who was going to die? How was it going to happen? You can't just pull this and then not, you know, wrap it up. So I think in a way, they used the film to wrap up the cliffhanger that Stephanie Meyer had created with her words that weren't in the book.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really neat. Because it's kind of like postmodern in a way. Like, I don't know. It's just...
Somewhere in those interviews, and I forget where, but there was some... And I'd have to, like, go back. I mean, at this point, it's so hard to find some of these old interviews because they're just so buried under, you know, years of different things. But there was one interview where she said that because Alice can see choices, and she can see choice by choice by choice by choice. You know, the second that Arrow makes another choice, she'll see what else the future is. And I remember in one of these interviews, Stephanie saying that if Alice kept realizing how badly the choices were going, she would willingly go with Arrow just to protect everybody and would show him the choices. But she said in what Alice would do, and she goes, and Jasper would immediately go with Alice because Jasper would never not go with Alice. But she said the second that Alice had the chance, she would kill herself so as not to be Arrow's pawn. So there's definitely, there's some of this buried in interviews from, like, you know, six years ago, but you got to, like, really dig for them.
Right, exactly. And I mean, that isn't, whatever she says in interviews, I mean, that's, you know, everyone's debating, is that canon, is that not canon, you know? And I feel like, well, with the movie, what it did was it took her quotes that she had said, sort of, she hadn't written it in the book, so it didn't totally count.
Mm-hmm.
But now they've taken that and used it for the movie and said, okay, well, if there was a big battle, and if they just started going at each other, Carlisle would die. Oh, my heart leapt. I was like, no! And then who else? Jasper would die, and Leah would die, and Seth would die, and all these people would die. And we got that to be canon, even though they didn't. And I thought that was brilliant, because we got that. You know, it's kind of like, excuse my comparison, some people will hate it and some people will also hate it, depending on which they prefer. But in the final Harry Potter film, you know, or book, you had all those big deaths and you were kind of left going, well, if there hadn't been all these big deaths, it would have felt really anticlimactic. But now these people are dead, and it makes me really sad, and Hedwig, and it's just terrible. So I feel like in this way, in some way, and some people might say it's a cop-out, but I personally am fine with it. I think that we got to have our cake and eat them too. whatever you want to say. I just feel like we got to see, wow, we got to experience, okay, Carlisle and Jasper just died. And then it was like, oh, no, they're fine. I like that.
Tarek, how about you? Because I know you have a totally different take on this than we have said so far.
Yeah. I love the battle. I agree with you guys that the battle was great. And, like, the second that they ripped Carlisle's head off, I was just like, what? Like, oh, my God.
Did they really just do that? I seriously thought they did for a second.
Seriously. I was just like, oh, my God. That did not happen in the books. I beat my friend's arm. I was like, that didn't happen in the books. Oh, my God. And then, like, the battle played out, and I was like, I really liked it, because I'm someone who actually really likes... Okay, this is going to sound morbid as hell, but I really like it when a character dies. I like that. I like the tragedy in that, just because I feel like it brings other people together, and it makes the story kind of more, like, realistic, kind of. Not to say, not to, like, insult this story at all, but like Harry Potter, I loved it when the characters die. Game of Thrones, I love it whenever he kills a character off, I'm just like, oh my god, I hate you, but I love you at the same time, because you're so strong for doing that. And so I loved the battle, and then as soon as they as soon as the vision thing turned out, like as soon as you saw it was a vision, I was just like, oh, well, I get it, because you would have a ton of fans. Like, I think the entire fandom essentially might just be pissed off if you didn't play off as a vision, and like people would be like, that wasn't in the books, that's not how the book was supposed to play out. And people would just be really, really, really upset. But I feel like it went the more, I want to say, the more realistic battle route. Like, that probably would have happened if it wasn't so like you said, Laura, like courthouse drama. And I feel like it was a cop out in my opinion, just because I think it would have been more realistic. I just would have loved it so much more if Carlisle actually had died. But
they would never have sold any merchandise ever again, though.
Oh, like, no,
the DVD says terribly.
Oh my god.
This is very true. Yeah. And so I totally understand why they did it, but I just would have enjoyed it more if it was actually like a battle and not a vision.
Yeah. Speaking of the battle itself, do you guys have any favorite moments within the battle? Because I know I felt like, because I saw it within 2 days on two different formats. I was really privileged to be able to see it on a big screen in an IMAX format, and then I got to see it in a regular movie theater format also. Did you guys, like, I know I felt like as I was watching this, I kept feeling like, oh my god, I can't wait to get this on DVD, because I wanted to hit the pause button and like go, whoa, like, who's taking out that person, and like, what are they doing in the background? Like, I felt like I really wanted to know what was going on in different places on the battlefield, because I felt like it was so intricate and there was so much going on. I really liked the creativity on how different people died. And then I also thought it was like really hilarious. And I'm like, man, they're losing limbs. They're losing heads. I was like, I've never seen so much, you know, destruction of human beings in a PG-13 movie before. So what did you guys, like, do you have any like particularly like favorite beats within that battle that you were like, oh man, I love that. That was like creative or original. What did you guys think?
It had to be when I forgot whose jaw got opened. But, like she took his head off by opening his jaw. I was like, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, I love
that. That was Caius, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was Caius, played by Jamie Campbell-Bauer. Yeah, who's going to be in the...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, who's going to be in the Mortal Instruments movie. He's playing Jace in the Mortal Instruments movie, which is probably going to be the next big, like, YA blockbuster. But, yeah, no, it was the character played by Mianna Burring, who was, like, one of my favorite new British actresses and people in this saga. I love her. I think she does a lot, no matter what she's in. And she was playing... Oh, God, not Kate.
Irina.
Irina? No, Irina's the one they kill. It's the other one. Tanya, that's it. Kate, she's playing Tanya, and she helped ripped his head off. I enjoyed that very much too. I thought that was awesome.
My favorite moment was when Leah saved Esme from falling into the pit. I thought that was just terrible and heartbreaking, and there wasn't enough Leah in the film. Actually, there wasn't any, except for her in wolf form. That really upset me, because I like her, so I really loved seeing a wolf sacrifice themselves for a vampire, because I like that conflict in the books and how they come to stand side by side, even though they're like mortal enemies by default.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny that you're saying, I like that movie too. I had remarked that one of the things that I wish we could have seen, but I guess in that scene it wouldn't have worked, if they died as a wolf, if, you know, once they're dead, do they transform back to human? Like, I felt like, because in that other moment was Seth, played by Booboo Stewart, like his wolf dies because he gets crushed to death by Felix.
And, by Dimitri,
sorry, wrong one. Too many vampires. And I just felt like, I don't know, I felt like it would have been more effective to, like, maybe see some sort of, you know, morphing with the camera from wolf into human. So you felt like it was, I don't know, do you guys think it's more effective to see an animal die or to see a human die? I don't know.
I think human, but I don't think they could show, well, then again, they did show a 2-year-old dying. I was going to say they couldn't show a 13-year-old dying, but
right.
They actually can. Can they?
I mean, I think Leah, you would have lost that because she just goes down the bottomless pit, and like by the time she dies, I guess she would be out of camera range, so you wouldn't really see it with Leah. But I would have, I don't know, I felt like I would have might have liked it better if I saw like him then morph back, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, I've heard that comment made a couple times that people would have liked that, just to feel a little bit more connected to the character that was the wolf. Because the wolves are hard to know specifically which one is which sometimes. So, I mean, luckily there are clear indicators for Leah and for Seth, but all the other ones, you had no idea who was getting hurt and who was attacking who, because they're just the wolves and there's so many of them. So I think that would have helped make the connection from character to wolf form as well, if they had transformed back.
Yeah. The other bit of the battle that I really liked too was Alice going after Jane. I thought, I
yes,
loved
absolutely.
That.
That was my favorite part.
Oh my God, I love that. And then she gets to feed her to the wolf that's played by Sam, who is, I just thought it was just wonderful that wolf was just like walking around like with a hand, someone's hand in his mouth, and he spits it out, and then he's like, yes, now I get to go eat Jane. Whoomp. I love that, because I don't know, I just feel like that's a character we all want to see get punished.
Ripped from limb to limb.
Yes, basically. Yes, like Jane, I don't know why, I don't feel like that about Arrow, but I feel like that about Jane, that she's somebody you just want to totally see that.
She's such a bitch.
Yeah, I mean.
She is incredibly vindictive in everything she does. There is no,
yes.
Like Arrow at least has a bit of a sense of humor, and you sense his playfulness about things. Jane just wants to be spiteful and use her power to take people out. Like, that's what she wants. It's the only thing she wants. You never see anything else from her but kind of this evil vindictiveness. Whereas Arrow, you see kind of this playful, wacky side with his creepy laughter, so.
Although, you know what else I like, too? Because, like, Marcus, who's sort of like the ultimate sad sack of the Volturi, you know, he's just such a shell of a person, and he knows he's going to die, and he puts his arms out, and he's like, finally. I love that. And then he gets sort of like spun around like a child's play yard set. I forget who takes him out there. Do you guys remember who it is that?
I think it's two wolves, isn't it? They each grab an arm and run.
That's right. Yeah. I just thought that was like, it was just creative. Like, I liked how every person was just going to get it a different way. I thought it was really, really creative.
I had a question for you, Laura. Technically, I know it explained it somewhere in the books, but I can't remember. It's been years. So when a vampire dies, I clearly remember that you had to, like, I know you have to burn them, right?
Right.
When they die.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, do you have to rip them apart and then burn them? Or can just ripping them apart suffice? Like, does that kill them?
No, ripping apart, because they can still, like, reattach, sort of-ish. If you remember going back to Eclipse, like, you have to rip and burn, because otherwise the pieces still kind of function weirdly. So, yeah, you have to rip and burn, and the venom is what's flammable. So you have to rip them open, and then they're not flammable until they're ripped open. But, yeah, that's how you have to do it.
Because that's what I thought, and it confused me for a little bit, because it feels like the only person in the movie that you see them torch was it Arrow, I think? That was the only person that they, like, you see Bella holding the flame against their head. And I feel like maybe technically they could have saved a couple of the people by reattaching them because they didn't burn everyone.
Right. You're right. You're right. That totally could have happened. But I mean, I'm assuming like the vision just didn't get that far to the ultimate burning or whatever. But yeah, exactly.
Okay. Sorry.
No. Ranting. Legit. Yeah. No. Totally legitimate question. Definitely. Totally legitimate question. You know, it's just fun. The only a couple of regrets that I had for the movie is I wished we could have seen more of, like, the fight training with Bella, because they definitely do more of that in the books, and I felt like the character of Zafrina didn't say anything other than you got to watch her stare creepily, and then you got to see her power. Like, I felt like in the books, like, to me, she and Kate were, like, equal at training Bella on how to do stuff, so I felt like Zafrina kind of got gypped of, you know, lines or scenes or whatever. And then the other person
who
I...
was creepy, though.
Yeah, and then the other person who I felt sort of got gypped of a moment is I felt that in the books there's this speech, and I guess they cut it for pacing reasons. I mean, I understand why, but there's this really awesome speech that Garrett gives about, you know, revolutionaries and why people act as they do and why he's standing with them. And I kind of missed that extra screen time for Garrett. So those are some things from the book that I imagine they have to make a cut somewhere or it's going to be a 9-hour movie, but those were things that I wished could have been in it. Anybody else have any items that you wished were in it or changed or different?
Actually, I did have one thing, which was, I'm not sure that this really mattered, but, you know, the book purist in me sort of noted this, and I was surprised I even remembered because it's been years since I read the book, but did they ever actually, because, you know, we haven't really talked about this at all, actually, but, you know, the final scene with Renesmee and Jacob and Bella and Edward sort of all off in the happy future, big happy Colin family, and you saw Renesmee grown up and Jacob still the same age, and it just occurred to me that they never in the film actually explained that Jacob wasn't a werewolf but a shapeshifter and that he could freeze himself at a certain age.
You're right.
So that's just kind of implied, and I was just thinking, okay, that you have to have read the book to make sense of that.
Yeah, there's a couple things like that, though, I feel like, that are in the books that if you haven't read the books, you don't understand that. Like, there's actually a whole collection of people that think that the fact that Emily has scars on her face meant that she went back to an abusive boyfriend, and I'm like, no, it means that the wolves when they first transform, they just they are just so explosive they can't control themselves, and she just got hit in the crossfire. I'm like, no, it doesn't mean that she went to an abusive boyfriend, or, like, you know. So I think there's a couple of things like that that if you don't know the books or haven't read backstory, you do miss looking at just the movies, and that's definitely one thing.
I thought that was really clear in that movie when they were explaining what happened. I can't believe some people just like, oh, abusive boyfriend, whatever.
It's a whole thing. Yeah, there's also a whole group of people that, I mean, I admit that the imprinting thing is a little weird. I mean, it's a little creepy, but, like, they tell you in the books, like, very distinctly, like, it's not like Jacob is in love with the 2-year-old, like, romantic love. It is not that, but there are still people that will say, oh, it's pedophilia, it's this and that. I'm like, okay, you can say that if you want, but that's not what, I mean, you can call it creepy, you can say, I don't like this, great, but I don't think you can sit there and say something's pedophilia when it's not.
No, you know? I think they got away with it fairly well, you know? I think that they, I mean, considering that this is a world where romance is somewhat creepy, I want to say, in general, you know, the whole imprinting and finding your mate kind of thing, because the vampires seem to have some, like, similar to imprinting as well, as far as I can tell, anyway.
Well, the other,
but,
yeah,
know, all that considered, I thought that it was a fairly obvious way of showing that he does love Renesmee above all else, but he can be whatever she needs him to be.
Right. What's also, I think, is kind of interesting, too, is that, I mean, in the books, it's sort of implied that, obviously, she may have a future with Jacob, but it's also implied that, you know, Nahul, who's the guy who comes in the end, like, is, you know, curious about her, and, you know, she's the first person outside of a member of his family that's like him that he's met. I mean, it's clearly very much implied there that, I mean, I think Edward even has a line like, I wonder where this is going to go in a few years down the road. But at the moment, you know, Jacob's thoughts are completely platonic and Huell is looking at it with great curiosity. So, I mean, if Stephanie Meyer ever does get around to writing other books in this series, like, it makes you wonder if he would not be some sort of antagonist that would come into a future book just by virtue of him, you know, looking at her with curiosity as to who she is.
That would be amazing. Why does that actor look so familiar, by the way?
Do you watch Revolution?
Yeah. Oh my God, is he the young guy?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I so didn't even notice.
Yep, J.D. Pardo.
J.D. Pardo.
Thank you. That helped.
I have to say that Taylor Lautner did a really good job at like portraying being imprinted on Renesmee, but not like being creepily in love with her. Like he was really, it was really good. Like you can tell that he cared about her and he did love her, but he wasn't like, oh my God, I'm going to marry you when you're 20. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's really creepy. Thank you, Dirk, for bringing in the creep factor. Woo!
Although, to be fair, I mean, in the olden days, that's pretty much what they did, isn't it? Like, they saw, like, some guy saw a baby, and he was like, she will make her my wife when she is of age. It's all Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
That was about money and territory.
That's true, so it's better. Or something.
Yeah, totally. You know, anybody have anything else to add before I get into like where do you think fandom will go and things like that?
Just really briefly, if we just want to talk about the Bella and Edward thing. I mean, I'm not personally a big shipper of theirs, but I gather that the shippers were very happy with the scenes that they got with them, or?
Yeah, I felt like people definitely, I was sort of surprised on PG-13 boundaries that, you know, they got rid of what was a pretty erotic scene. I was like, okay. So clearly, I mean, there's more of those scenes in the first movie, but even in this one, I was just like, okay, that's like, I was like, PG-13 movie. Okay. I'm pretty stunned. I had to laugh though. There's a segment in that whole scene when they're in the cottage and he's sucking on her shoulder blade. Apparently, according to Bill Condon, they had to go back to the censors with that scene 3 times and like do it frame by frame by frame for them because they thought he was sucking on her nipple and they had to prove to them that it was a shoulder blade. Because
really funny.
Because if it was a nipple, it was going to go R, but when they proved that it was not a nipple, it was a shoulder blade that it got PG-13. And I'm like, oh my God, that is so hilarious. No, it is not a nipple. It is a shoulder blade. you know, so
funny, isn't it?
Like, yeah, I thought it was pretty good. The one thing that I will say was interesting because I did say I got to see it on 2 different size screens. I got to see it on an IMAX format and I got to see it in a regular format. I hated that scene on the IMAX format. It was a little too big and in your face. And when it got to like the orgasm part, when you had this like sparkly gold in the background, it looked ridiculous on the IMAX screen. I mean, just, it could not look more ridiculous if it tried. It was better on the regular screen, but on the IMAX, I was like, oh, that doesn't look good on IMAX at all.
That's funny.
Yeah. During that whole scene, there was this kid in my theater who I think was like 8 years old or something, but he was just like, and then he continued to laugh throughout the entire movie. And then he laughed like when Edward was playing piano or something. I was like, oh my God, what is so funny about Edward playing a piano? And I had to turn around.
For life.
And then I noticed that I think the poor kid was autistic. And then I was like, darn it, because the whole time I wanted to murder him. And then I felt so bad.
Aw, and then you couldn't be mad at him.
Exactly.
Wow, imagine taking an 8-year-old in to see that film, though.
Yeah, it was crazy. Like that, they really did push the boundaries.
That's actually something that I find is interesting too. Is, and a lot of people have brought this up, that it is a PG-13 movie. And I mean, I know, like for me as a parent, when I would go to a PG-13 movie when my son was younger, I would check out with other neighborhood kids who are older, and I'd be like, okay, why is this a PG-13 film? And I would kind of make the decision as to what my son could or couldn't see based on his age and what the content was. I can't imagine taking my much younger, like 8-year-old age child to a PG-13 midnight screening. Like, I can't imagine taking the 8-year-old to a midnight screening, like just to begin with. And then especially one with a very heavy, what could be violence and, you know, romance that I'd then have to explain what's going on.
Right.
I was just like, why, you know, it's like, you know what, get a babysitter. I know that's probably like not considered a very cool thing to say, but I'm like, you know what, for the audience going public that is not looking for a kid to be there at the midnight showing, like seriously, get a babysitter. It's kind of, especially when like the kids are like, what's that? It's like, you know, you're like destroying everybody else's movie going experience. Like not every movie is right for everybody. Like maybe use a little discretion.
Completely agree. Yeah, it was a little ridiculous, and I had to put him in the back of my mind the entire time.
Yeah, I just had giggling schoolgirls behind me kicking my chair, but that was a bit more to be expected.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't care if it's, like, 12-year-olds. Like, you got to figure, like, a 12-year-old, you know, can understand, like, whether or not they're mature or not. But, you know, they presumably have the basic facts of life by the time you're 12. But, like, there are people that really bring, like, 5-, 6-, and 7-year-olds. And I'm like, how do you think that so much of this content is, like, appropriate for them? Like, to me, I would be like, if I had a 5-year-old and there's this a scene right there of a baby being chucked in a fire, that would really alarm me that my much younger child was seeing content like that, you know? So anyway, my 2 cents, stepping off my soapbox. But yeah, no, I think the romance was like really good. And I think a lot of fans also really liked, you know, the end and the way that they showed Bella taking down the shield and they did this montage of all the other scenes. I think most fans really, really liked that overall montage, that even if you had like people who were not generally speaking like emotional criers in films, like that scene got them. I feel a lot of people, they really liked that montage at the end. One of the big questions that I keep seeing people popping up with is like, so what's going to happen to the fandom now? And I just kept feeling like it's like, to me, it's like probably like, I don't know. I felt like it's a bit of a silly question. Like there are people who are Lord of the Rings fans and have been Lord of the Rings fans, you know, since the books came out, before the Peter Jackson films. You know, it's been 10 years between Peter Jackson's films, and those Lord of the Rings people are still there. You know, Star Trek people, Star Wars people have been around forever. You know, Harry Potter. I mean, I feel like Twilight fans will still be there. I mean, maybe it's not going to be at the same passionate level it is right now, but I feel like fandom will still be there for people who want to be there. What do you guys feel about this? Is like Twilight, you know, going to be any different than other big fandoms? What do you think?
I think for the most part, the fandom will always have been brought together by Twilight, but I think it's, in some cases, it's a little bit different than the other fandoms. Yes, Twilight will always be what maybe brought people together or got people interested in reading again or in certain types of books, because I think what Twilight did for a lot of people was introduce them really into young adult novels. Mm-hmm. Because I think that really wasn't someplace a lot of adults went to get books because they didn't think that they could. And I think Twilight introduced the young adult genre to a lot of people, or category. Some people call it, it's a category, not a genre. So a lot of adults were brought into that, and a lot of adults kind of found their way into book blogging and into young adult books in general. So I think what will happen is you'll have this base fandom of people who loved Twilight, who were brought together by Twilight, but who will then branch out into different things, like you said, The Mortal Instruments or Beautiful Creatures or Divergent or The Hunger Games, because I think it all starts with a base fandom and then fandoms kind of morph and change into whatever is kind of next or whatever they love next, and they can find a group of people that also love and kind of get together and talk about it. It's really about being social and discussing something you really like with other people rather than, you know, reading it, loving it, and then having no place to share it. You know, the internet has made it so that you can share all your opinions on stuff, whether they be good or bad. And so I think that that's kind of what fandom is becoming in general, is just kind of, it shapes and shifts to what you like as a person and where you can find people that are also interested in what you are interested in.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I actually think that because a lot of people, they sort of, they attribute this renewed interest in the YA category and the sort of surge of these YA adaptation movies to Harry Potter. But I think that both Harry Potter and Twilight have had a big impact on this surge, because I think where Harry Potter is very action-based and very magic and very fun and very sort of rich and mythological, I guess is the right way to say. You know, Twilight is that more contained inner story, because it literally is inside Bella's head that all this happens in a different way. And I think a lot of the fans overlap between the two, so I wouldn't say it's a different fandom necessarily, but I think it has brought something more introspective to the genre, and I feel like we can see elements of both in the books that and movies that become popular now. And I also think that the Twilight fandom has sort of had to endure a lot more because it's faced so much criticism, and I think it's taught people to get really passionate and defensive almost of their fandom. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I think part of it is
that Twilight is predominantly a female fandom. And that's not normal in a lot of ways. Not until recently, at least. If you think about it, Star Trek, Star Wars, those are, the Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. Up until recently, those were all predominantly male-based fandoms. And so when you have a predominantly female-based fandom, people just don't know what to do with that. And I think we've experienced that a lot, like going to Comic-Con. If you were a Twilight fan at Comic-Con, you were like the bottom runner. People hated you. People made fun of you just because you were there.
Oh, it was
like,
stupid.
No joke.
Yeah, it was just
these
like,
are people dressed in costumes all the time. And they were making fun of us because we were standing in line for something.
Yeah, I know. You wanted to go, let me get this straight. Your fandom has pointy ears, people with yellow blood, and who have gotten married using their own brand new fake language, and you're calling me weird? I just want to check. You know, it was... Yeah. You just want to go, you know, dude, there's enough room for everybody. And what I thought was the biggest, like, just the hilarity of it all is that they're like, oh, yeah, well, the Twilight fans are all gone. And I'm like, no, jackass. And if we can't swear in this podcast, just cut that out. But I'm like, no, jackass. The Twilight fans are still here on the second, third, fourth, and fifth days of Comic-Con. Like, they're here all week long, and they're participating in other fandom. You just don't know it, moron, because now they're wearing a Walking Dead t-shirt. Now they're wearing a Doctor Who t-shirt. Now they're doing, you know, the Hunger Games, whatever. They've crossed over into so many things, and I think there's this stupid presumption out there that Twilight fans only like Twilight, and that's so completely not true. Most of the people who I know who run Twilight sites, right now the biggest Hunger Games sites on the web are all run by people who got their start in Twilight. The biggest, every single last one of those sites that is huge is run by people who started in the Twilight fandom. And that's even true when you look at some of the big Mortal Instruments sites. It's going to be true on some of the big Divergent sites. You know, so I feel like, you know, people like to talk smack, but smack is just smack. They don't know what the real story is. And I think you kind of said it, Selena, the Twilight fans have gotten, like, we've got our armor on. It's like, you know what? I know who I am. I know what I stand for. I know what else I'm into. If you feel the need to attack me based on a presumption, well, that says a lot more about you than it does about me. And, you know, I'm not about to engage in a battle of wits with an unarmed opponent. You know, I don't need to defend myself because I know who I am. I think that's what it comes down to for a lot of fans.
Right. But again, and I think what the Twilight fandom did as a whole was bring kind of female fandom into the forefront, into, you know, movie makers' minds, into the media's minds, and into these other fandoms that just didn't know. Like, honestly, I don't think they knew what to do with a bunch of women who liked one thing. Like, I think they were a little, like, no joke. Like, if you read some of the interviews and some of the things that the press said early on about all these women, because at first they thought it was just teenagers. It was, oh, teenage girls. And then they realized, oh, no, wait, these women are not teenagers. These are grown women. These are professional women. And I really don't think anyone knew what to do with that. In some cases, I still don't think they know what to do with it. Like, they don't know what to do with these women who are well-educated and smart, but really, really love these things and are willing to go and camp out on the street for it. Like, nobody knows quite what to do with it. And I think that's really interesting concept in and of itself, is that people have no idea. Like, it's okay if you have the men who want to sleep out for Star Wars all day long. That's fine. They know what to do with that. It is what it is. But when you have women who do the same thing, it becomes this completely, you know, odd thing that they just get confused over. So... I mean, I don't know. I think it'll be interesting to see, but I think, like I said, the fandom will morph and shape. As Laura pointed out, a lot of the bigger fandoms coming up, Divergent, Mortal Instruments, and Hunger Games, all have ties to the people in the Twilight universe. And just like Twilight has a bunch of ties to the people that were in the Harry Potter universe. So it's really all just connected. And again, the fandoms morph and change as different things come up because, you know, your story is done. This saga is done for now. We have nothing else to be excited or invested in, so there's something else out there that we all like, so now we're excited and invested in that instead. So,
you know, the last thing I think is really, and I think Harry Potter had a lot to do with this too, is that when it comes down to it, I always say, it's the story, stupid. You know, at the end of the day, you had a story that people really loved and were passionate about, and at the same time, when that story got converted to screen, granted, there's going to be changes, there's going to be cuts, because you just can't get everything up there. But at the end of the day, the story in the novels wasn't radically dissimilar from the story on screen. And I think that's what gets fandom going and builds upon fandom, is when what you see on screen is not entirely unrecognizable from the book you read. And I feel that's why something like a Harry Potter succeeds, that's why a Twilight succeeds, and at the same time, it's something like a Golden Compass and an Aragorn. fails miserably because right. they diverged so much from what was the core, and they just ticked off their fandoms, you know, versus I felt like these movies were even a rallying point for the fandom and even made fandom bigger, because there were people who used that movie as their entry point, and then they were like, oh my God, now I have to go read the books. And I feel like that was definitely a Potter thing, and I feel like that was definitely a Twilight thing.
Well, I was going to say, another thing that's really important to take note of is that, for example, Percy Jackson strayed drastically from the source material of the book to the movies, okay? I mean, drastically. So much so that I don't know if they can ever recoup and get back on track. And the one thing that's really important to note in that is Rick Riordan has never seen the movie, and he does not support the movie.
Oh,
whereas
interesting.
You have Stephanie behind the movie, you had, you know, J.K. Rowling behind the movie, and upcoming Modern Instruments, you have Cassie Clare behind the movie. They've all been on set. They've all been involved. And I think that makes a world of difference, too, is that when you have an author who's involved and, you know, works with the production company and works with the source material and, the, you know, it all comes together, you have a really strong base and a really strong fandom. Whereas in the case of Percy Jackson, that wasn't the case. They didn't keep what they should have kept. They changed a bunch of stuff. It didn't work. And now you have an author who doesn't support your project. Guess what? The fandom was started because of the books and because of the author, not because, oh, look, there's going to be a movie. So if you don't have that support, you don't have a fandom. It's not going to work. So I think that's another really important thing to kind of note as we're talking about it, is that the connection between the author and the movie and the source material is a really important thing.
Definitely. Anything else we want to get into before we wrap this up?
I had one final question for you guys. Is being the Stephanie Meyer experts that you are, do you think, what do you think the likelihood is of Stephanie Meyer ever returning to the Twilight universe and doing some kind of Renesmee-centric story?
I think she'll do Host sequels first, because we have the Host.
Yeah,
so we have the Host movie coming out in March. And this is, again, buried in an interview somewhere. I think it's a Twilight Moms interview from the Breaking Dawn 1 red carpet. I may be wrong on this. I'm close, though. And in the course of that interview, she states that she has 10 years to write the sequels. It's a trilogy, The Host, The Seeker, and The Soul, that she has 10 years to write the trilogy before, quote-unquote, someone else can write it. Now, she's a hands-on kind of person. I don't see her letting somebody else play with her toys. So my gut is that she is now going to be busy writing the sequels to The Host, and since a solid 5 years, if not 6 years, has already elapsed since she wrote the first one, then she's kind of got to get busy writing. So I think that we're going to see two more Host sequels come out of her, and there's going to be Host movies. So I have a feeling that she probably will return one day, but I don't see her returning to it for a decade. That's my personal feeling. And that's not, like I said, inside knowledge. That's just kind of putting together pieces, but I don't think it's happening for 10 years. And every so often there's this interview that says, oh yeah, she's going to do it, and it's going to be this spinoff or that spinoff. And the fact of the matter is unless Stephanie Meyer releases her rights to somebody, it's not like Lionsgate or Summit can do anything with that material. She has to release it to somebody else, and she's a hands-on kind of person. I just don't see her doing that.
No, I think she'd have to do it herself. I would just, I don't know, ever since Breaking Dawn, the second book came out, I was in Ireland when I remember this randomly, and it was in bookstores, and I bought it, and I read it in a night. It was great. Ever since then, I wanted the Renesmee story. Like, I almost was more interested in that than the Bella Edward Jacob thing, because spoiler alert, I was Team Jacob. So I was upset at first, and then I warmed up to the idea of the future story of Renesmee and Jacob, and potentially this other hot guy that I forgot the name of. And I would love to see something like that. I really hope she does it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like she doesn't have the source material in her head. I mean, even, you know, before she decided to give it a rest, I mean, she had talked about, there were interviews about her talking about her having like a potential book 5 and 6 in her head and where that story would go. And she's always said if she continued again, it would, you know, Bella and Edward's arc has wrapped up, which leads you to believe, well, if their arc has wrapped up, whose arcs are left in the open? And very obviously, it's Jacob and Renesmee. It's also Leah. You know, so yeah, I mean, I would be, I mean, believe me, I would love to get more books in this universe. I just don't think it's happening before a decade, despite the fact that every now and then somebody thinks they've got a nugget of something and going, oh yeah, the sequel's coming out. Nah, it's not happening for a decade. That's my thing.
Okay, so that was the Breaking Dawn reaction discussion. I thought that went really well. I hope that you guys are satisfied with that. I can't believe there are no more movies, but I'm sure that they'll, I mean, we'll probably end up talking about Twilight at some other point as well. So this probably won't be the last time, but at least we got a good sense of the movie. Maybe once the DVD comes out, we can revisit it and talk a bit more in detail about something.
Yeah, DVD. And you just know they're going to do like a special edition collector's kit or, you know, right. Does anybody not do the special edition collector's kit? You know it's coming.
And who knows what was left on the cutting room floor? I mean, I've heard some things, so
okay.
It'll be really interesting to see if they're on that DVD.
Yeah, the special R-rated edition. I'm sure it will be. But yeah, we'll be revisiting that. And next week on Vampire Hype, we will be coming back to the Vampire Diaries and talking about the episode My Brother's Keeper. We've also got some interesting Dracula series news coming soon that I can't wait to talk about because I'm really intrigued with the show. I think it's going to be really interesting. Okay, and thank you to Jen and Laura for coming back. We haven't really talked much with you guys since we were the Secret Diaries chat. It's very sad. We miss those times. And we hope to hear you again soon on the show. So if you have any comments for us about Breaking Dawn Part 2 or about Vampire Diaries or any other vampire fandom, you can tweet us at Vampire Hype. You can also go on hypable.com. That's hypable.com, where we have all the latest news and information about all these different fandoms, as well as posts where you can download these different podcasts and you can also leave us comments. And that is everything. Thank you guys for joining us again. We hope to hear from you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. When someday you take, open your mouth, boy. Someday you take, show me what you got. Someday you
take. So start recording in 3, 2, 1, go. Oh, a phone. You're all good. I'm going to assume you're all good.
Yeah.
I just remembered we had to do contact information, so I will do that now and then come back to this with the magic of editing.